like the cut of your jib, young man. You seem to be one of the ones who gets it. But now I have to go. I've got a special secret meeting in the tunnels underneath Congress.
Wait, what goes on in those tunnels?
Nothing. Forget I said it. I've said too much. Forget about those tunnels, too. Just stop thinking about tunnels. Goodbye.
Okay, thank you, Senator Schumer.
Freak out. Don't freak out. Don't freak out.
All the voices performed today are by the one and only, the inimitable Mike McRae. He can be found at MikeMcRae.com. That's it for this week. You be the best you can be, and I'll keep being me.
This is Julian Assange. You're listening to WBAI New York. Stay strong and keep listening.
Welcome to another episode of Gray Zone Radio. In this episode, Max Blumenthal and Aaron Mate are joined by Dr. Sattara Siddiqui from Isfahan, Iran, to discuss the recent terrorist attacks there that claimed the lives of around 100 people. After that, Max calls a Washington Post reporter on the live stream to confront her about the hit piece that she was planning to write on the Gray Zone and the Electronic Intifada. And then Max and Aaron cover the collapse of the Hamas rape allegations. To listen to the full live stream, you can find us on YouTube. You can find the link at thegrayzone.com. That's the G-R-A-Y-Zone.com. You can also follow us on Instagram, Telegram, and Twitter. Now let's take a listen to this week's show.
Terrorist bombing 48 hours ago claimed the lives of well over 100 people. Close to 300 were injured. This was at a family-oriented pilgrimage to the grave site of Major General Qasem Soleimani, the former leader of the IRGC, whose presence is felt in a very powerful way right now. And we want to bring in our guest, Sattara Siddiqui. How are you doing, Sattara?
I'm pretty good.
Good. I know it's late there where you are. You're in. Well, tell us where you are and just introduce yourself to our audience, because I think you'll do it better than I can.
Sure. So my name is Sattara Siddiqui, and I'm currently based in Isfahan. That's where I was born and raised, and I'm a PhD in American Studies. I've worked as a freelance journalist and translator, and I'm also a teacher. I teach about U.S. politics at university here with university students here.
Well, we're grateful for the work you're doing and for all the contributions you've made to the Gray Zone. This terrorist bombing in Kerman took place amid a wave of assassinations, a U.S. assassination of an Iraqi militia leader in Baghdad, an Israeli assassination of a Hamas political leader and lead negotiator with Israel, Salah Arouri, in southern Beirut. And I incorrectly stated that you were in Kerman during this bombing, but you had friends there. You've talked to eyewitnesses, so tell us what you've learned about this.
What
happened?
Yeah, so you know that General Soleimani was very, very popular among Iranians, and his funeral back 4 years ago was reportedly the biggest funeral ever recorded in history. And the images show that. Like, it was on different international channels, and huge crowds that came out in different cities showed how popular he was with the vast majority of Iranians. And this annual commemoration for him has been going on for 4 years this year. And I was actually thinking of joining my friends who were going there, but I had to attend a few work things here, so I couldn't. I talked to my friends. My friends who were there heard the explosion, but they were not in the vicinity of what exactly happened. But I also talked to like friends of friends who were in near where the terrorist attack happened. And as you said, it's like a family oriented pilgrimage, and people go with their children. Actually, more than, I think, 53 or more than that of the martyrs so far have been women. 30 of them, if not more, were under 18 years old. And you will have like 2-year-old babies among the victims. So it's very tragic. And I remember, like, I was just, I wanted to make sure that my friends were okay. And I messaged them, and, you know, I went also on social media to check what people are posting. And some of the friends or people that I was following were saying that they were okay, but they were near the incidents. And some people even witnessed, like, baby girls with their heads burned. And or if I think you have also seen that initially the numbers were reported as higher, but then they were adjusted, which was because there were so many body parts, and it was very difficult. I mean, they were rapidly trying to, you know, count the dead bodies and the and take care of everything that was happening. So it's been very tragic. But the interesting thing is also that exactly the next day, which was yesterday, there were even more and larger number of people coming to the site where the terrorist attack happened to show that they're, you know, they're loyal to General Soleimani, and that these attacks are not going to push them back from defending what they believe in, from their values. And they also wanted to obviously attend the funeral for some of the martyrs. There were also 13 martyrs who were not Iranian, most of them Afghan refugees that were attending the event, and they were killed in the terrorist attack.
So who do you think is responsible? We've seen if the Islamic State claim responsibility. This is from the video in which they claimed responsibility. It's a very unusual looking video, because as we know from the Iraqi and Syrian experience, when there was a terrorist bombing or a suicide bombing by ISIS, they would show the face of the perpetrator after he died. They, you know, would honor him essentially. But here they're wearing masks. There have been arrests in Kerman of the supposed attack team and collaborators. One is from Tajikistan. But, you know, the MEK is the, you know, People's MEK, which is backed by Saudi Arabia and Israel. They often carry out terrorist attacks inside Iran as well. So what's going on here?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, everyone is talking about how unusual this statement by this ISIS is, because as you said, not only they honored him, sometimes even you would see a video of the perpetrators, like they would make a statement before going on the operation, like taking pride in what they're doing. But this time we're seeing that their faces are covered, which is very unusual. And it also somehow took them a longer time than usual to announce that, to take credit for the terrorist attack. Even before the ISIS announces or takes credit for the terrorist attack, everyone was talking about how it is either, I mean, the operation is carried out either by ISIS, MEK, or directly from Israel. But in all the three cases, I would say, who is behind them? Like, who has trained and funded MEK, who has trained and funded ISIS, and who is funding the ongoing genocide and all the crimes and the occupation of Palestine by Israel? It has always been the U.S., and Iranians know that very well. MEK is one example. There are a very notorious and rejected by all Iranians, a terrorist group, and they used to be on U.S. and EU's list of terrorist organizations. Even when they were on the list of terrorist organizations, as Simon Hirsch wrote about it back many years ago, they were trained in Nevada during Bush administration by Mossad and the CIA, the two carry out assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists inside Iran. So these kinds of assassinations and terror attacks were also something that people were expect from the MEK, because they have also, the MEK has also previously carried terrorist bombings inside the shrines. As I remember when I was probably a teenager or something, that a lot of people were died in the shrine in Mashhad because MEK carried out a terrorist bombing. But the thing is, whichever of these, like the MEK or ISIS, carried out the operation itself, it doesn't look like this is coming, you know, I mean, like the masterminds behind both terrorist organizations have always been the US and Israel. And this is something that Iranians know very well. Even though the US and like spokespersons from the US government try to say that, like, you know, we have nothing to do with this, but Iranians remember the 1953 coup. They remember how the US supported Saddam in its eight-year war on Iran, how they funded MEK. And people have can also read your book, Max, about management of savagery and how ISIS and other terrorist organizations have been created by the U.S. government and funded. And like, so it doesn't make the U.S. innocent in any ways. And that's how the majority of Iranians are looking at the thing.
And we have the last sort of ISIS terror attack on Iran that I can remember in 2017, some gunmen ran up in the Iranian parliament in Tehran and just massacred people. And Donald Trump came out and essentially endorsed this attack, endorsed ISIS, and said those who commit terror will essentially get what they bargain for. Almost implying a U.S. hand in that attack. We also have the Mossad chief, David Barnea, stating on the day of this attack that those who took place in October 7th will sign their own death warrant. Okay, we've heard that before from many Israeli officials, but he actually stated at the funeral of the Mossad's founder, Zvi Zamir, one of their founders, that he is going to continue Zamir's hunt for the 1972 perpetrators of the attack on Israel's Olympic team at the Munich Olympics, which led to this war of the spooks in the 1970s, bloodshed across Europe. It looked like, by the way, the Mossad was using, at that time, their version of ISIS was Abu Nidal, who is a supposed Palestinian militant, but the only attacks he carried out were on the PLO, on the PFLP, on Palestinian interests. So every Palestinian understood Abu Nidal to be basically an Israeli agent or a double agent. And so we're seeing these kinds of attacks all over again. It looks like Israel wants to destabilize not just the region, but this could go to Europe as well. Who knows? To Latin America, even to here. I want to ask you, we've got to move on to a lot of topics, but I want to ask you, Qasem Soleimani's successor, Hossein Salami, the head of the IRGC, has vowed revenge. You can see right to the left, or maybe it's, yeah, to my left of this headline, the Israeli Defense Minister, Yoav Gallant, declaring time running out for diplomatic solution to Hezbollah tensions, meaning Israel is likely to escalate with Hezbollah after this attack in Beirut. How do you think Iran is likely to respond here? And how do you think Iran's allies, for example, in Hezbollah, might respond?
Well, it looks, I mean, it definitely is clear that Israel is looking for more attention and for getting Iran and the resistant groups in the region, in Iraq and in Lebanon, involved in various, you know, sorts of attacks, so that they cannot have a more concentrated response towards Israel. And Israel wants to have the U.S. involved in all these tensions, so they have some military backing because they cannot I mean, we're seeing that this is basically because they're feeling that they're losing the war against Hamas and against Palestinians. I'm sure there will be some sort of response by Iran and Hezbollah because the resistance figures are being killed in Iraq and in Lebanon, and innocent people have been killed in Lebanon and Iraq, and inside Iran, innocent people have been killed. And it depends, like how the response will be, will depend on the more details, the intelligence details that will come out. Because so far, at least 9 people have been arrested, and Iran is still working on the details of who has been, you know, behind the attacks and where they're getting their information from and everything. And as you mentioned, ISIS also last year carried out 2 other terrorist attacks inside Iran, inside a shrine, at the peak of the unrest that were also part of Israeli and U.S. Intelligence operations inside Iran. MEK had a very major, had a, like a major role in what happened last year. And something around 60 police officers and security forces in Iran were killed. And Bolton was bragging about how they managed to get the arms to the so-called protesters. Iran has been waiting for the time to respond to all of that. And the public opinion in Iran really demands a strong response by Iran, but also a response that is strategically wise and gets the results that the people and the Iranian government wants.
Just one last question. This attack came at a march commemorating the assassination of General Soleimani. And I'm wondering if you could talk briefly about why he's revered so strongly inside Iran. And I'm wondering if you could respond to the process to how he's characterized in the U.S. So a standard account, like in the New York Times, reporting on this attack, on this march, says that Soleimani is regarded in the West as a malign actor. And then it talks about how, yes, he did play a role in defeating ISIS inside Iran, inside Iraq and Syria. But the Times says he did that alongside a U.S.-led coalition. So that basically the Times is trying to say that the defeat of ISIS was done by the U.S., this U.S.-led coalition. And Soleimani, yes, he played some role. But the main actors here in defeating ISIS were the U.S.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, like we remember the accidentally dropping of the weapons for the terrorists like ISIS in Iraq and Syria by the U.S. And I mean, the U.S. was so obsessed with getting rid of Assad that they did not really care about who they're aligned with and who they're armed. And just wanted the Syrian government to be removed because they were not, you know, they were not doing what the U.S. wanted. But inside Iran, Qasem Soleimani has been respected and admired for not only the fight against terrorism and against ISIS, but also the fight against Saddam Hussein. He was a key figure in the during the like Iran's defense against Saddam's invasion. And he has been a big part of all Iran's defense strategies for many years, and people know that he has dedicated his life and his, he has sacrificed everything he had to protect the country and protect the Iranian people from any invasion. And he was, you know, like aside from, or besides his military, capabilities, he was also a very modest man. He was very, people oriented. He was very humble. He interacted with people. He checked on the families of the martyrs very often, and they called him uncle, and he was very soft spoken as family man. So the image that Iranians have of him is like they look at him as an uncle who protected them, who defeated not only ISIS but also Saddam, and he was the mastermind behind all Iran's capability to deter the attacks. And you know that Iran has always been on their, ever since we had the revolution, we have been on their threats from Israel, from the Ba'ath regime and the Saddam regime from the U.S. And of course, Saddam's invasion of Iran was totally backed and funded by the U.S. and a few other European countries. So this is how we remember Qasem Soleimani. And I mean, there are a lot of people who are taking pride and in wanting to be a follower of him and just follow his cause. That's how we remember him.
Eric T. Red, Eric Thomas, who's helping us out from behind the scenes, made a great comment. Imagine how the U.S. would react if some foreign adversary did this to them. There is no general or military figure as revered as Soleimani was in Iran in the U.S. But just imagine if that took place, what the U.S. response would be. And we've seen nothing but strategic patience from Iran. But I think the other than the attack on the Al-Assad airbase in Iraq, in which the U.S. seems to have been notified a little bit ahead of time, there were no U.S. casualties. There were head injuries, but there hasn't been. We haven't seen Iran's full capacity. And going back to my previous comment about the 1970s, the War of the Spooks, based on what Israel's been doing and its announced intention to kill political figures around the world, this opens them up to the same possibility. Obviously, reciprocity is real. So we will be continuing to follow that. And Sitara Sadeghi, thank you for joining us from Iran, scholar, journalist, and translator and contributor to the Gray Zone. You know, we'll continue to have you back because I think this story is going to be just as relevant next week or in the coming few days.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Max and Aaron. It was nice talking to you, and I look forward to seeing you both again.
Thanks so much for your time. We were contacted by the Washington Post, I guess 2 days ago, and I didn't know it because it was buried in our public emails, which I review. I mean, I review every email periodically. I review them as much as I can. This one, so I learned about this one because Ali Abu Nima of Electronic Intifada tweeted his response to this reporter. Let's pull up Ali's response because I think it was a very similar email that we received. And you know, the email didn't come with any questions. Elizabeth Dvoskin, who goes by, who signed off as Liza or Liza to us, reached out to Ali and said, I cover social media for the Washington Post, and I'm writing a piece about efforts to minimize or misdirect information about the October 7th Hamas attacks on Israel. As part of the piece, I'm noting various headlines on your service that point to evidence of Israeli deaths being caused by the Israeli army. I'm noting that many people I've spoken to who believe that the IDF was responsible for the October 7th, cite the work of Electronic Intifada. So basically misrepresenting what Electronic Intifada did or attributing to them a conspiracy theory that Israel was wholly responsible for the October 7th attacks, when actually what they were reporting, as we did at the Gray Zone, was that Israeli military officials gave orders to attack Israeli civilians on October 7th if they were being held captive by Hamas militants. And we saw many Israeli civilians killed. This is confirmed. I was called a conspiracy theorist by Haaretz for reporting this, and Haaretz ultimately reported it. So Elizabeth Dvoskin reached out to me as well. And you know, I mean, it's very revealing. The language she uses here is very revealing. She's accusing Ali and Electronic Intifada of minimizing October 7th attacks. That was the language to me, but the email was much shorter. I'd like to talk to you about your minimization of these attacks. There are no questions. Usually a reporter will supply questions and I can answer them. And they just basically left a phone number. And Ali responded, it's a great response.
Well, so Max, so she didn't send you the dimensions by which you've minimized October 7th?
No.
No.
No, it wasn't like 1,200 by 800, and I reduced it to 800 by 600.
Got it.
But, you know, I mean, you look through this reporter's social media. She is like the Silicon Valley social media reporter for the Washington Post. And you know what that means? It means pushing the imperatives of the censorship industrial complex and of the Western intelligence services. She hyped up Russiagate massively. You know, you look at interviews with her and she's howling about Macedonian teenagers exploiting divisions in the U.S. to hack the brains of American citizens and spawn fake news. It's just ridiculous. But she's also a dyed-in-the-wool Zionist who's retweeting Barry Weiss. This is Daniel Denver. If it weren't clear enough, Liza Dvoskin was planning an anti-Palestine hit piece from the emails below. Check out her timeline. Nonstop pro-Israel propaganda. Screenshot of tweets followed by excerpt from shared articles. You know, okay, here's, you know, here she is retweeting Barry Weiss on stuff we've debunked about October 7th and the whole Hamas rape propaganda that the Israeli government's pushing. Here's something Ali discovered subsequently, that when Washington Post's Liza Dvoskin was at Columbia, she denied the Nakba, claiming there was no Palestinian nation in Palestine with hundreds of villages and cities, was home to just a few desert Bedouins. That's who's assigned to write this article about electronic intifada in the gray zone, a voice from the D.C. protest. Before the British swept in, Dvoskin writes, there was no Palestinian nation. The territory was taken from the ailing Ottoman Empire and consisted of desert Bedouins without a sense of national identity as we know it today. What, like, how ignorant do you have to be to believe that? That's like Leon Uris level propaganda. This is the person assigned to write this hit piece for the Washington Post.
Wait, Mac, leave that quote up for a second. Leave that quote up. Because, this is a common talking point from Zionists, and it really misses something important. When the British swept in, what the British did is they immediately promised the land to somebody else who was not there, which was the Jewish people. Yeah. There was a tiny percentage of Jews there in Palestine, but the majority were Palestinian Arabs. And yes, in the years after the British promised the land of Palestine to somebody else, you did see Palestinian nationalism grow. I mean, the line about desert Bedouins is just a straight up fabrication. But yes, when someone comes in, when you're living in a land and like it's yours and some colonial power comes in and promises it to somebody else, you're going to develop all the more of a national identity. That's just obvious because your land is being stolen. So this idea that like there were no Palestinians until the British came along and then all of a sudden the Palestinians like decided they wanted to be a people. No, what happened was the Palestinians realized their land was being stolen from them and they organized around that to stop that. And of course they failed. And that's why we're in the situation we're in right now.
Right. I mean, it's just transparent Zionist propaganda. So, I mean, it's obvious EI's having an effect. We're having an effect. That's why the Washington Post came. The Washington Post did not do the investigation. They will not do the investigation that we did, which Israelis are talking about. Israelis are talking about how Israelis were killed on October 7th. This will be discussed if there's ever an independent investigation or an investigation inside Israel, if the Israeli government will ever allow it. The Washington Post won't touch it. They want to attack us for doing the work that the U.S. media should be doing on one of the biggest scandals of this war.
Yeah.
Other than genocide, of course.
Yeah. And how, so what was the one mention that we see, at least that I've seen in the establishment media, of the fact that Israel killed some of its own people on October 7th? It was in the New York Times. It was buried in the bottom of a New York Times article. And the Times described this Israeli tank that fired on a home that killed Israelis as some light shelling, right? It was a light.
They was hit with light shells, like Nerf light shells.
Yes. So that's the one instance where New York Times, where establishment media in the U.S., as far as I know, broke its own oath of silence around Israel's role in killing its own people. And the Times buried it in an article at the bottom and described it as light, just a light show. It's just a light
show. Well, what that article revealed or told the U.S. media consumer was that Brigadier General Barak Hiram, who is a major figure in the Israeli military, major figure, he's being put forward as like this hero of Gaza, that he gave the order to fire on the Pessi Cohen home in Kibbutz Be'eri and kill something like 15 Israeli civilians knowing that they were in there. And then he lied about it in interviews afterwards and blamed Hamas for killing everyone there. So this, it's a huge scandal. And Electronic Intifada, Ali Abu Nima and David Sheen broke this story that he lied. They put the pieces together. They did the translation. And now they're being attacked for breaking a story. Do you see how U.S. corporate media operates? They're attacking real journalists for doing real journalism because it's undermining the public relations imperatives of the apartheid state of Israel, with which Liza Dvoskin enjoys a deep affinity. So I don't know. She wanted me to talk to her. She's looking for some kind of gotcha moment or something. Let's give her a call. This is the number that I have for Liza Dvoskin of the Washington Post, social media reporter. I don't even know why was this person assigned to this story? Anyway, let's talk about it, because our work really speaks for itself. But I think we have some questions for them.
You've reached Elizabeth Dvoskin's voicemail. You can leave me a message here.
I guess you don't really want to speak to me. Let's try one more time, because you never know. Here we go.
Hello?
Yeah, hi. Is this Elizabeth Dvoskin?
May I ask who's calling?
Yeah, hi. It's Max Blumenthal from the Gray Zone, and I'm here with my colleague, Aaron Mate.
Oh, okay. Thank you so much for calling.
Sure. Yeah. You wanted to talk about our factual journalism?
I did. I want to interview for my piece.
I got an email from you accusing us of minimizing the atrocities on October 7th.
So I'm wondering if it's possible, because I'm about to be on another call, if we could schedule a time to speak Monday or Tuesday. Obviously, won't run the fire to that.
I'd like to talk right now before we do that, because I am confused based on the language in your email. You are accusing us of minimizing atrocities on October 7th, but you're not. It doesn't seem like you're. I'm trying to figure out what you're trying to do here and why it seems like you're planning to attack the investigative journalists who have helped expose a major scandal, us and Ali Abu Nima, which has been confirmed even by Israeli media and by Israeli military officials like Colonel Golan Vak, in which Israel killed Israeli civilians on October 7th. There were friendly fire orders. You're attacking us instead of doing the investigation yourself on this scandal. And I'm really confused about why that is.
So I definitely want to talk through everything. I don't want you to feel attacked. I want to talk you through points in the story. I'm of course aware that there were deaths due to friendly fire. And I've read the Israeli media reports as well, some of which you cite. And let's just.
So how are we minimizing? Just tell me now, how are we minimizing atrocities by reporting these facts?
So I'm about to be on another call and you're kind of springing on me. What I appreciate doing is scheduling a time to talk so that I can hear everything that you have to say and talk you through everything. Just the way
question is for you. No,
wait, Aaron Mate has a question. It's not at all that I can't always get him here.
We didn't contact you. You contacted us. So we want to hear from you. What is your issue with us? How are we minimizing what happened on October 7th? If you believe that, since you wrote it, it should be easy to explain. So let's hear it.
So I appreciate you asking me questions. My other call is starting, asking me questions. My other call is starting in a minute.
When is your other call over?
I don't know. It's another interview. But I just...
We need to have trust. We need to have trust before we go any further. And I see that you have minimized the Nakba of Palestinians writing for Columbia University's paper. You describe them as just a bunch of desert Bedouins. Are you a Zionist?
You know, I'm not sure.
I see you retweeting Barry Weiss, who's a major supporter of the Israeli genocide in Gaza. And I need to know, are you ideologically committed to the system of Zionism. And it's very curious that someone like that would be assigned to this story. And it's also curious to me that the Washington Post refuses to investigate the real story and hold accountable this powerful apartheid state and is instead attacking independent journalists. You are afflicting the afflicted and comforting the powerful, as the Washington Post has traditionally done. So why should we even trust you to set up some kind of call?
I mean, that is completely up to you to do so.
Are you a Zionist?
Sir, that is completely up to you to set up a call. This isn't about any personal biases, ideologies. That's not what this...
Do you support Israel's military campaign in Gaza?
Excuse me, what is it? I feel like you're interrogating me and my other call is starting.
You deserve to be interrogated. It's highly inappropriate that someone who seems to have such deep affection for an apartheid state committing genocide would be assigned to this story and is attacking independent journalists who produced factual journalism on a major scandal instead of holding to account the state and military responsible for that scandal. And by the way, why is the Washington Post always minimizing genocide, the attack on the Maghazi refugee camp? It was referred to as just strikes against Hamas in the Washington Post. Where is this? You're the social media reporter. Where is the report on all of the Israeli social media posts, the TikTok posts celebrating the genocide of Gaza, mocking people in Gaza for having their water and energy turned off, the Israeli soldiers in Gaza proudly committing war crimes on TikTok, broadcasting it to the world? Have you written one story about that as the social media reporter?
So feel free to send me anything, any articles or clips that you think...
Feel free to answer the question.
Being a subject that you feel free to send me any articles or clips.
See, this is why nobody trusts corporate media and why they're reading Electronic Intifada and The Gray Zone, because you can't even answer these questions. You can't even tell us about your own Zionism and why you're doing this hit piece.
I'm really just taken aback.
Why? I'm taken aback.
Okay, well, I apologize for being taken aback, but I feel like the next step, the natural step that anyone does when one is interviewing a story subject is, or anyone who's mentioned or has a reference in a story, is to talk the whole thing through, to schedule a time and talk it through. So that's all I'm saying.
You didn't even ask me in the email to schedule a time or talk it through.
So I apologize.
You could have sent questions.
Because I'm running late to another call. So I'll send a follow-up email to your email with suggesting some times. Does that work?
Do you still believe that Palestinians, that the people of Palestine were just desert Bedouins before Israel?
Okay. Liza Dvoskin of the Washington Post has hung up on us. She has said that she has another call that's so important that she can't interview or discuss this issue with her interview subjects, and she won't address her own pro-Israel sympathies, which are obviously relevant to this story. So,
well, that's a pretty typical interaction with somebody who tries to write a hit piece on the Gray Zone. We've done this many times before with people. When we call them and ask them for the evidence for their claims against us, they universally are unable to engage and oblige, and that one was no exception.
That was Liza Dvoskin. So much for that. We should do we have the Russiagate interview she gave? I don't have it in the doc, but I mean, she is such a tool of power if you look at her work. She did a 2-year investigation on how Russian propaganda was responsible for the coups in West Africa. As if the destabilization of those countries by the U.S. invasion of Libya, assault on Libya, wasn't actually one of the major factors, or the miserable state of their governments just selling off their resources wasn't a factor. No, it was the Russians. And she spent 2 years doing that. This is the kind of stuff that's obviously guided by Western intelligence services. She's guided by power to attack any countervailing force.
Yeah, well, this is her pinned tweet, so she's very proud of this work. The backstory of the recent string of coups in Africa is Russian disinformation. this never told spy versus spy tale with wild deets like getting people to play avatars in the real world reveals how it happens. Been working on this for 2 years. So basically, coups in Africa, all the result of the same source, the all-powerful Russian disinformation, the same way that Hunter Biden's laptop was Russian disinformation. Hillary Clinton's loss to Donald Trump, that was Russian disinformation too. It all comes back to Russian disinformation. And that is Elizabeth Dwoskin.
Or whoever is puppeteering Elizabeth Dwoskin. I mean, who, what journalist wakes up in the morning and is like, you know what? I want to write about how Russia is influencing people in West Africa to overthrow their governments. Like, who actually does that unless they're the biggest bootlicker of power? Again, like, how is it not this just titanic scandal that Israel attacked its citizens on October 7th? What, even if you want to say this was Hamas's fault because Hamas militants had taken them captive or were taking them captive or had attacked Israel, how is it not a massive scandal that we have just clear testimony of Israel shelling home after home in Kibbutz Be'eri, killing children, and that the Israeli government then goes and presents those children as Hamas victims? How is it not a scandal that people are coming out of Gaza who are abducted by Hamas, who are Israeli citizens, going to the war cabinet meetings with Netanyahu and the war chiefs and pointing their finger at them and saying, why did you try to kill me with an Apache helicopter on my way into Gaza? And why do you all keep bombing all around us? Do you want to get us killed? Well, how is that not a huge scandal? It's just something that so the only way the U.S. media will touch it, this is always the case. Whenever our reports get into mainstream media, it's to attack us for daring to write the reports. It's like Kit Clarenberg's blockbuster reporting on, the leaked emails showing that a British intelligence cabal, including former MI5, MI6 chief Richard Dearlove, was infiltrating the British civil service and sneaking out classified documents belonging to Theresa May in order to manipulate Brexit and destroy Theresa May. This should have been a huge scandal across the UK. Instead, when The Guardian reports that, they report, we think Russia may have gotten these leaked emails. And that's the only story. And then Kit gets interrogated for daring to break open this scandal. This is all the corporate media is just protectors of power. Now we see they're protecting the authors of the worst genocide of our time. And that's Liza Dvoskin. That's her ultimate legacy. So we wanted you all to see that. And know about that and hear her response to our questions and our concerns before we would talk to her. And I think if she had wanted to open up a frank and candid conversation, we would have been open to continuing. But
one day we can put out a special compilation of all our favorite Gray Zone live phone calls. I'm thinking of the time I think Alex Rubenstein spoke to someone from the National Endowment for Democracy and like gave them a history lesson of their own organization's role in cooing foreign governments. And there was a time when I called up Mark Townsend of The Guardian after he printed that article claiming that I'm the most prolific spreader of disinformation on Syria. And of course, he couldn't offer
that was
me
classic.
One example.
Forgot about that.
We'll have a whole compilation one day.
And so you were trying to ask her right when she hung up about her comments referring to Palestinians as a bunch of desert Bedouins. And then she hung up.
Yeah. I mean, just so ridiculous. Before you try to write about this topic, you should understand the basic history. And what she was repeating there was just the mythical version of Palestine and the Zionist narrative that this is all just desert Bedouins inhabited this place before the Jews returned to their ancestral homeland to make the desert bloom. It's such a joke. Such a joke.
Well, I'm looking forward to the article, and actually I'm not. I know what it's going to say, and it's a lot like the articles that are we're getting attacked like every day in Haaretz in liberal publications for publishing facts and raising serious issues with Israeli propaganda, and it's just very similar. It's like this was inappropriate for you to do. This just violates our sensibility.
And what's interesting there is, you know, the contrast between Israeli media and U.S. media. Of course, Israeli media is dominated by state propagandists, but in Israeli media, there's still more critical reporting on Israel than you can find in the U.S. So Israeli media has reported a lot more on the fact that Israel killed some of its own people on October 7th. And Israel has correspondents like Gideon Levy and Amira Haas, who there's no contemporary for them inside the U.S. These are Israelis that are very critical of their occupation. Amira Haas has lived inside the occupied territories for decades. There's no comparable columnist in the U.S. media. There's not even, you know, there's Amira Haas and Gideon Levy. There's not even one inside the U.S. The closest you can get is Peter Beinart, who occasionally writes the New York Times, but he constantly peddles to the Israeli narrative in ways that Gideon Levy and Amira Haas don't even do. So it just shows that in the U.S., it's a lot harder to report critically and just factually on Israel than even inside Israel itself. And not that Israel is a beacon of press freedom. Of course it's not, but it just shows how corrupt and Orwellian our system is here, that it even outdoes Israel in its servitude to Israeli state power.
Yeah, and I mean, okay, go write for Haaretz or whatever, like the Jerusalem Post. How does U.S. media think they can just get away with having like open Zionists leading their news coverage on Israel-Palestine at this point? Like people who are Israel advocates, whether it's Jake Tapper or Dana Bash or Liza Dvoskin, like they don't allow Palestinians to operate except as fixers who share bylines with the white reporter from the U.S. who puts everything into proper prose and brings in the Israeli voices and makes sure that the Palestinian narrative doesn't penetrate too deeply. That's the only way Palestinians can get into U.S. media.
The term fixer is actually so offensive. Like, you know, the native is my little fixer.
I mean, they're basically the producer.
Yeah.
Who
do all the work. All right. Well, should we move on?
Yeah, I mean, we could, I think, transition into something related with the New York Times and the whole Hamas rape, the collapse of the Hamas rape propaganda.
Okay, well, let's get to, you know, the story we've been closely debunking when few others are willing to do it, which is this claim that has been put out there that Hamas used sexual violence as a weapon in a systemic fashion on October 7th. And we pointed out the evidentiary flaws in this from the start, starting with Israeli police quietly admitting they have no physical or forensic evidence of a single rape on October 7th, starting with the fact that there are no purported victims of sexual violence on October 7th who survived, who've offered direct testimony. So the only testimony comes from these people who claim to be witnesses. But the problem there is, as we pointed out, their stories are both outlandish and full of contradictions, with people changing their stories multiple times. And one of the latest blows to the narrative came when the sister of a woman named Gal Abdush, she was killed on October 7th, came out and accused the New York Times of manipulating their family and holding her up as a symbol of sexual violence on October 7th. And the New York Times story, which was widely shared, a lot of people took this to mean finally we have some definitive proof of sexual violence. But the sister comes out and says that actually there's no evidence, and she said this in an Instagram post, she said there's no evidence that Gal Abdush was raped. She pointed out that the timeline was impossible because they actually heard from Gal Abdush in a message, and about 9 minutes later she was killed. And when they heard from her, there was no mention at all of any rape or sexual violence. And so, as the sister said, would they have had time to do all these things to her, to rape her in a span of 4 minutes? It just doesn't make any sense. And the sister also accused the New York Times of misleading the family, because she says that when the Times came to her, came to the family, they didn't tell them that they were doing a story about sexual violence and that they were going to call their sister, their daughter, a symbol, the symbol
of sexual violence and claim that she was raped when the evidence.
So Mural Alter in this January 2nd Instagram comment that you see stated, and this is a quote, "She was not raped. There was no proof there was rape. It was only a video." Alter also pointed out the timeline between the last message of her sister, last message by her sister to her family, and the time of her reported murder made it impossible for any rape to occur. How in 4 minutes were they also raped and burned? She also wrote, and this is a quote, "The New York Times that came to us indicated that they wanted to do a story in memory of Gal and Nagi, her husband, and that's why we approved. If we knew that it was a headline like rape slaughter, we would never agree. Never." So that's devastating, because Gal Abdush was exhibit A, the woman in the black dress at the top of the New York Times story. And so then this, you can look at the Instagram post here. You'll see on the left is a propagandist, an Israeli propagandist named Yosef Haddad, really a sleazy Hasbarist, who is talking about the girl in the black dress based on the New York Times story. And that's when her sister decided to intervene and say, "You can't do this. This isn't true. You are abusing the memory of my sister who was killed brutally along with her husband."
And look what the Times did. The Times put the family on the cover of the story. So this is the family of Gal Abdush. Her sisters are there. Interestingly, the Times doesn't name her sisters, doesn't say their names. It doesn't really interview them very much. And you have to speculate what was going on there. Maybe that's just an innocent mistake, or maybe the Times was aware that her sisters did not buy the rape claim, and so that therefore didn't tell them, which we know they didn't do because the sisters say that, but and also didn't talk to them, didn't really interview them. They quote them very briefly. It's really strange behavior. Of course, the main Times reporter on this, Jeffrey, what's his name, Gettleman?
Yeah.
Has not responded to any of this. Of course he hasn't, nor has he responded to all the other holes in his story, including the fact that they rely on documented fabulous from the rescue group Zaka, Max, as you've reported at the Gray Zone. They were caught lying about so many other atrocity claims, including confirming the story, the fake story about dozens of beheaded babies. Times doesn't mention that, nor did they mention the contradictions in the other witnesses. But the fact that, you know, the headline there, "How Hamas weaponized sexual violence on October 7th. This is projection. It's the New York Times weaponizing sexual violence and the bodies of dead women to accuse Hamas with no evidence of sexual violence. And the aim is clear: to lend the Times imprint, its esteemed imprint in the eyes of many people, to the Israeli government as it carries out a mass murder campaign. Because this talking point that Hamas committed this unspeakable sexual violence, that's been used by Israel to help justify its mass murder rampage. So that's what the Times is doing here and going along with this. And they're even willing to exploit a grieving family and a dead victim to do it.
And it gets worse for the New York Times here, because it's not just Gal Abdush's sister who has come out and contradicted the New York Times reporting and essentially condemned the New York Times. It's her brother-in-law, Nisim Abdush, who is the brother of her husband who was killed. Her husband, who, by the way, appears to give very strong indications that he was with her at the time of her death. Which also would have made rape impossible. He was later killed. We'll get into the circumstances of that at another point, because there's still a lot of mystery there. I addressed Gal Abdush's killing in my piece on October 7th, Friendly Fire Casualties, back in October. And it was clear then she wasn't raped. Her killing, however, was terrible. Gal Abdush's brother-in-law gave an interview on January 4th to Channel 13 about the New York Times article, and he denied that she had been raped. He also contradicted the New York Times, and he said it would have been impossible given that she was with her husband. And he also went after the international press and said, you know, they're going to sensationalize this story. But internally in Israel, we need to basically tell the truth. Because if we're talking about this in Hebrew, the false claims of his sister-in-law's rape will do psychological damage, further psychological damage to her orphan children. So he's basically telling the Israeli press, like, don't believe the New York Times, don't repeat their lies, but let them continue to say this to the world, because we need the support of America. I mean, and we even have the mother made some interesting statements too. Her name is Eddie Bracha. Eddie Bracha told the Israeli publication Ynet that the first time they heard that her daughter had ever been raped was from the New York Times, and that the New York Times tried to convince them that she had been raped, but the Israeli police had never done so before. So this is crazy. I mean, this is highly unusual and manipulative behavior by Jeffrey Gettleman and these other journalists to actually come to a bereaved family that's vulnerable, that's grieving, and to tell them their daughter was raped.
You've been listening to Gray Zone Radio. In this episode, Max Blumenthal and Aaron Mate were joined by Dr. Satara Sadeghi from Isfahan, Iran, to discuss the recent terrorist attacks there. After that, Max called a Washington Post reporter to confront her about a hit piece she was going to write on the Gray Zone. And then Max and Aaron discussed the collapse of the Hamas rape allegations. To listen to the full live stream, you can subscribe on YouTube. You can find the link at thegrayzone.com. That's the G-R-A-Y-Zone.com, where you can sign up for the newsletter to be notified of future live streams and other updates. You can also read the news that's published there. And you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Telegram. Thanks for listening. I'll see you again next week. I've been your co-host, Christopher Weaver.
Join WBAI and WPFW for the March on Washington for Gaza, Saturday, January 13th at noon. You'll hear voices from Palestinian family members affected by the horror that has unfolded in Gaza, along with political and social leaders. The rally aims to both raise awareness about the atrocities the Israeli government is committing against Palestinian civilians in Gaza with U.S. support, and it calls on President Biden to support an immediate ceasefire. That's Saturday, January 13th at noon, the March on Washington for Gaza on WBAI New York and WPFW Washington.
Becoming a buddy through the BAI Buddy System is simple. Donate as little as $10 on a monthly basis, thus forming a relationship that benefits you, the listener, and us here at 99.5 FM. Simply visit give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org. And donate today. We are a listener-supported radio station. But as a buddy, WBAI can also support you.
If you're filing taxes, you may be eligible for some pretty unique deductions. For instance, there are write-offs for clarinet lessons. Or if you hired your cat for pest control, apparently there's a tax break for that too. But if you don't think you'd qualify for pet-related deductions, you could just donate a vehicle to WBAI. It's easy, free, and tax deductible. Here's how it works. Call 866-WBAI-CAR. That's 866-922-4227. Or complete the online form at WBAI.org/donate-your-car. From there, our vehicle donation support team will take care of everything, including the pickup, sale, and provide you with a donation receipt. If your vehicle sells for more than $500, you'll also receive a 1098C tax form. So, instead of writing off your cat patrol, you can support programs like the Cat Radio Cafe by donating a car, truck, RV, or boat. Call 866-WBAI-CAR or visit WBAI.org/donate-your-car to get started.
He's exciting.
This dude is bad.
He's sexy. Okay, maybe not. He's a bad mother.
Shut your mouth.
He's Tony Ryan on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. He's got both.
Break him with the sound of the trumpet.
Can you dig it?
Yeah, I can dig it, yeah.
He's got classic soul. He's okay. I can't think of anything else.
I'm Tony Ryan. Tune in Saturday nights, 10 p.m. to 1 a.m.
Soul Central Station with Tony Ryan.
99.5 WBAI.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for a celebration. The award-winning Midnight Ravers can now be heard every Friday from 12 midnight to 2 a.m. So wake the town and tell the people. We'll continue to present the best in music, history, and social commentary, along with expert